Welcome to the ABCA's podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Brownlee. Our sponsor is Core Energy Belt, the trusted source of professional baseball players in both Japan and the USA. With over 700 professionals, including two former MVPs, relying on these belts, Core Energy has established itself as a leader in performance and durability. I've been wearing their belts for a while now, and the added back support has made a noticeable difference both on and off the field. They offer free shipping and a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. Go to coreenergybelt.com and use code ABCA2025 to save 15% on your first purchase. I'll repeat that. Go to Core Energy Belt and use the code ABCA2025 to save 15% on your first purchase. This episode is sponsored by Netting Pros. Netting professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, turf, turf protectors, dugout benches, dugout cubbies, and more. Netting Professionals is an official partner of the ABCA and continues to provide quality products and services to many high school, college, and professional fields, facilities, and stadiums throughout the country. Netting Professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or info@nettingpros.com. Visit them online at www.nettingpros.com or check out Netting Pros on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn for all their latest products and projects. Make sure to let CEO Will Miner know that the ABCA sent you. Now on to the podcast. I want to thank everyone that listens to the ABCA podcast. This is the 300th episode that I've recorded. I have a blast doing this, and hopefully we're providing value to the baseball community and humanity as a whole. I know on the outside it looks like society is divided, but I get reminders every week of how close together and similar we all are. If I can be of service to you in any way, please reach out to me, and as always, leave it better for those behind you. This week on the ABCA podcast, 2025 ABCA Hall of Fame inductee Belmont head coach Dave Jarvis. Jarvis recently completed his 27th season as Belmont skipper in 2024. Since he took over the program in the Bruins' first NCAA Division I season in 1998, Jarvis has compiled 763 wins and is the program's all-time winningest coach. Jarvis has over 1,000 wins with his previous head coaching gig at his alma mater, Three Rivers Community College. Jarvis had a successful stint as an assistant at Murray State. On a personal note, Coach Jarvis is one of the most humble people you ever meet, and he epitomizes what it is to be called an ABCA Hall of Famer. Let's welcome Dave Jarvis to the podcast. All right, here with Dave Jarvis, ABCA Hall of Fame this year. Congrats, Coach, but head coach at Three Rivers Community College, was an assistant at Murray State, but 28th season here at Belmont, so congrats, Coach.
Yes. Well, thank you. I can't tell you how blown away, how both, and everybody says it's humbling. It is humbling. I'm just telling you, but I'm very honored by it. And especially to be an organization that I hold in such high regard as the ABCA, to be recognized by them, the people that put forth my nomination, I was totally blown away by that as well. It's just, it's a great honor that I feel like I've been blessed with. For sure.
Well, you're going to be in that group now when people see you at the convention. Like, who was in that group when you first started going to the convention where you're like in awe of the guys, you see the Hall of Famers walking around? Who was in that group?
Oh, the Paul Skolinas, the, you know, Gordy Gillespie, of course, Ron Polk, you know, Cliff Gustafson, you know what I mean? It's just, you look at that and you're 20 some years old and you're thinking, man, those guys know everything. And just to be included in that group, I'm really, you know, when I'm talking about these names, like guys like Johnny Reagan or Itchy Jones or some of these people, you know, it's just, you think about it and I try not to think about it. It's really overwhelming at times.
Were you able to get your speech down to 5-6 minutes?
I haven't written my speech yet. If I'm being totally honest, we've had a lot going on program wise this fall. And so I figure that's something over Christmas when it slows down. But, you know, I don't hate public speaking, but I don't really like it that well. I'll try to keep mine in that 6 minute time frame pretty easily, I think, because I just really want to thank some of the people that gave me my start. And, you know, in 43 years of coaching college baseball, I have worked for two different coaches that hired me as an assistant. So I spent 6 years as an assistant coach during that, which, by the way, were probably six of the best years of my life, because you're not nearly as, you know, stressed out as an assistant coach. You know what I'm talking about, right? And then I've had three athletic directors in 43 years, all great, great men, great athletic directors, unbelievable accomplishments on their own, you know, standing. So I want to thank those people. I want to thank my assistant coaches, and, you know, so it's not going to, I don't think it'll take me a long time to do that, but I'm grateful for it.
Do you think that's something that assistant coaches should hear right now? Because everybody, when they're assistant, they're like, I need to be a head coach. I want to be a head coach.
Yeah, I think they should hear that, because, you know, I've been really fortunate here. As you well know, some of my assistant coaches have stayed with me for a long time here at Belmont. Started out with somebody like Chris Mottlemog in the beginning, but then, you know, I get a guy like Jason Steen, who's now back with me now for a second stint. He stayed with me for a long time. Scott Hall was another long-term assistant. But then Aaron Smith, I mean, 14 years. Matt Barnett, 17 years. You know, I've really been blessed with some long-term assistant coaches, but throughout my career, I've had just unbelievably good assistant coaches that have made me look a whole lot better than I probably really am.
Well, you guys have a perfect combination there, because you have a great private school, but then you're right in the middle of Nashville.
Yeah. Belmont, of course, is a world-class educational opportunity for these kids. It's a great environment. It's a great learning environment. And then you put that inside the city of Nashville and where we're located, that makes the cost is probably our biggest prohibitive or biggest hindrance. You know, when you're $60,000 a year, that can get in the way of some of your recruiting for sure. But then, you know, when you look at some of the positive things that we have, we got a lot of really good things going on. And to be honest with you, even more so than like when you were a player, because I remember you as a player in that age group, or I was a player, kids want to be in a place like Nashville now more than they did back when we were going to college, right? I mean, I was thrilled to go to Jonesboro, Arkansas and play at Arkansas State. I thought I was in the big time, you know, going just to Jonesboro. So, you know, it's a good place to be and a good school to do it at, for sure.
Do you have any on your roster that have gone through the music program at Belmont?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've had several kids that have gone through it and gone through the music business program as well. We've had, you know, two or three kids that have actually reached some level of fame or fortune, you know, in the music industry as well. We've got one young man that a lot of people haven't heard of, but his name's Wes Langlois. He was one of the first kids that I had back in the early 2000s that went through our music program here, and then has had a lot of success as a musician and a guitar player, things like that. Was in a movie about Hank Williams here just a few years ago, and played a pretty good role in that as well. And then, you know, you skip forward to, Brian Kelly, you know, BK, with Florida Georgia Line. He's half of Florida Georgia. He's the Florida half of the Florida Georgia Line duo, and their success, man. I mean, they took off when they dropped Cruise. I had seen him just about a month or two before the song Cruise dropped. And he told me, he said, "Coach, man, we got some really cool things getting ready to happen. I got a feeling here." And 2 months later, I hear Cruise, and boy, they took off like a rocket ship. And then another guy is from more of a folk pop techno kind of band. But, you know, we've got Judah Akers, who is kind of a lead in Judah and the Lion, which is they've had a lot of success, even on a worldwide stage where they're touring places around the world and doing a lot of really cool stuff. And all three of those guys are just wonderful men that I'm just proud to be affiliated with. Love for it. Sure.
Speaking of an assistant, when you're an assistant at Murray State, when did you figure out that my dad had thrown the pizza boxes off the bus?
We actually saw him putting them off, and we were plotting because we were all hungry. We didn't get post-game meals, you know, back in that day. And so when we saw your dad setting those pizzas off, we were like, yes, we're eating for free tonight.
You know? You're being too kind for people. There's a lot of people don't know this story, but my junior year, we go to Murray State. We always played Murray State home and home. And so we were going down there. We had a hard time winning at Murray State. And we messed up a first and third play late and got beat. And I get on the bus, and our trainer had put the pizza boxes in my dad's seat. And at that point, you're too scared to even do anything. Like, should I grab a box and take it? Because I knew what was going to happen. And I should have just picked them up and moved them across the aisle, and we would have been fine.
Back, yeah.
But as soon as he got on the bus and saw those boxes on his seat, he flung. You're being nice. He threw them. He didn't set those down. He frisbee tossed those off the bus. So,
well, he put them off in such a way that they didn't leave the box and hit the pavement. I will say that they were still inside the box. So my kids are running. They're all scrambling down there. As soon as that bus pulls off, they're not even out of the parking lot yet. And we're gathering up pizzas and taking them back to the dugout.
The good thing is Murray's close to Evansville, so it wasn't that big a deal. But that's stuff you can't do now. You could, nor should you. Hopefully my dad's listening. Dad, you shouldn't do that to people.
Well, I can't say I haven't done the same thing, but your dad's always been one of my favorite guys. I mean, we kind of come from that same old school baseball, hardcore mentality. And there, I knew what he was doing, because there's been a few times when I haven't fed teams, because that was one of the things that you were sending a message to your roster. You weren't trying to mistreat anybody in any way whatsoever. You're just trying to send a message, about winning and what's not acceptable, you know?
And I hear my dad right now, if he's listening, he's like, well, if they wanted to eat, they should have played better.
That's right. They should have executed that first and third play a lot better as they should have done.
How's the switch to the Missouri Valley been?
It's challenging. I mean, it's a really good league, as you well know. You've been around the league enough to know that it's a really good league. You know, Indiana State has just been so good these first two or three years that we've been in the league, so talented. Mitch, of course, just a tremendous teacher and coach, and runs such a good program now that he's moved down to South Florida. And you got Tracy Archuleta coming in, and he does the same thing, same guy almost. You know, Tracy does a great job. They're both really good baseball coaches. Missouri State, with all the tradition and the success that they had over there under Coach Gutton, another really good program. And you know, you can go on and on and on about it. I've had the really good fortune. I've been in three different leagues as a head coach here at Belmont. We started out in the Atlantic Sun Conference, which was a great league as well. It was 8, 7, 8, 9 ranked conference in the country during those years when we first were getting in. Loved all the coaches that they had in there. Were all really good. You know, I mean, guys like Smoke Laval and, you know, Pete Dunn and Terry Alexander and some of those guys that are just unbelievable. You know, Craig Gibson down at Mercer, another great coach. But then you go into the Ohio Valley Conference. Again, I knew all of those coaches well and really like competing against those guys. And so many good coaching staffs in there. And then you get into the Missouri Valley Conference for this third league, and same type of situation where you get into the league and you get into those coaches meeting rooms and things like that, and you just go, man, this is going to be tough, but it's going to be fun, because you know people are out there teaching baseball right and doing it the right way and going about things in a really positive way.
Yeah, it always seems like there was some camaraderie with the coaches in the Missouri Valley.
Yes.
And maybe you didn't get in some other leagues.
Yeah, they're very, you know, it's that odd thing where it's a league, again, like the other two leagues, where they take pride in their program, they take pride in the way they go about their business and how they conduct themselves and their players conduct themselves. but they also take pride in the entire league. And so when you're not competing against them, they're pulling for each other, you know, and that's how sport should be, I think.
You had the opportunity to coach your son, Logan.
Yeah. Yeah. Jackson as well had been in our program, and he's now here working with us as well as a, you know, student undergraduate in our program. But yeah, Logan played for me for, you know, a long time. He was in our program with COVID and medical hardship and all those type of things. He was in our program and, you know, turned into a really good player for us as well. Was, you know, had some accolades that had come his way as a player.
Was that always the plan for them to come to Belmont?
No. I have three sons, Jordan, Logan, and Jackson. All three of them just great men that I'm very proud of. They're 31, 27, and 23 now in age. And my buttons pop when I'm thinking about them or talking about them. But they're all really good men. All three of them, the thing about Belmont is we have a really good tuition benefit as an employee. And so that was a big factor for me. Now, Jordan, he didn't have interest in pursuing college athletics, but again, a good educational opportunity that would be provided for him. And then Logan was pursuing baseball and kind of put all of his eggs in that basket when he was in high school, left the basketball program and, you know, some of those things, and had some offers from some other Division I schools when he was coming out of high school. But he, as you mentioned, had interest in our music business program, which now he is pursuing some of that as a songwriter and trying to learn that craft and go into that actually, if that's what God has in mind for him, that's what he wants to do. He's coaching high school baseball and doing songwriting a lot and mowing a lot of grass and things like that to make ends meet. When he made the choice to try to come and play for us, I just told him, I said, well, my goal is to treat you just like every other player and treat every other player like they were my son. So that's what I've tried to do. And then, of course, Jackson came and was a player in our program for a semester. And then due to he got caught up in the 3 years at a junior college during COVID. And so there was, you know, there was a transfer or a progress towards degree issue where he was there for six semesters and not all of that was transferring into Belmont. So he ended up leaving and going to Reinhardt and playing for Jonathan Burton down there, but which was a great experience for him, played on another great team down there as well too. But now he's back and working with us in our baseball program. So just, you know, Belmont's been a really good place for all three of my sons. And, I'm just, like I say, all three of them, I'm just so proud of who they are and the men that they, the potential that I see in them, for sure.
Do you think that's the best tip for somebody that's got to coach their child is you got to treat them the same as everybody else? Or maybe be harder on them a little bit?
Well, I was very conscious of that too, because I had seen a lot of other coaches that had gone through that. I mean, you're a coach's son, you played for your father, so you understand this dynamic that I'm talking about what I did is I turned it over a lot of times to my assistant coaches and would let them work under their direct supervision. And I think that helps a lot too. We create a little bit of a distance and let them stand on their own. And then I would have a conversation with them, you know, too, about, listen, you'll have people that'll test you or try to, you know, they'll say stuff about your dad to see how you react. And I said, don't ever take that personal. Let them, you know, if they're saying, hey, that guy is crazy, you know, you jump in and go, you think he's crazy? I've seen really crazy out of that guy, you know, or whatever. I said, get on board with it and just let, you know, just be a teammate is really what we tried to do and the way we tried to handle it. So, like I say, it all worked out. And I think the goal, like I say, is to try to treat them like every other player and treat every player like they were my son, which a lot of coaches do that, I think.
I never got a break because I had to deal with my brother also.
Yeah.
There wasn't anybody for me to go to.
You had no sympathy whatsoever, I'm sure.
What'd your time at Three Rivers do for you?
Boy, it did everything is from a preparation standpoint. It taught me so much. I was hired I got a phone call, and it's a little bit of a lengthy story, but I'm a graduate student at Arkansas State. I've received a graduate assistant teaching assistantship there, and it's the summer of 1982. And my plan is I'm going to be at ASU that fall. I'm going to be teaching PE classes and working on my master's degree. And, you know, hoping, I'm even thinking, well, maybe I'll go into teaching and just try to be a college physical education and health instructor and physiology instructor and so forth. So that's kind of my plan. Well, the girl that I was dating in college at that time, her sister lived over in Joplin, Missouri. Now, mind you, this is 1982, so there's no cell phones, no communication. And 4th of July weekend, she just says, hey, Dave, you want to go to my sister's house in Joplin, Missouri? And I was like, yeah, let's go. We got nothing to do for 4th of July. So we go up to her sister's house, and we're sitting in the kitchen floor playing with her nieces and nephews. At that time, they're all little kids, and we're just hanging out playing with them. And I'm telling you, Ryan, the phone rings. It's one of those old kitchen wall telephones that just hangs on the wall. And when it rang, I just felt some energy charge go through my body. It was a weird feeling. And I thought, that's for me. And we're in Joplin, Missouri, 5 hours from Jonesboro. And it's my old junior college baseball coach calling me at her sister's house, which we didn't tell anybody where we were going. And she answers the phone because it's her sister's house. And she goes, yeah, he's sitting right here. And when she said that, I just thought, ooh, this is too weird. And she hands me the phone and I answer. And it's Roger Patillo, who I played for in junior college at Three Rivers. And he goes, what are you doing, boy? And I'm like, coach, how in the world did you find me? And he never did. I never gotten to, you know, Roger has passed now. He died from ALS, you know, at about age 48. But I never got him to tell me how he found me over there in Joplin, Missouri. And so going to Three Rivers, you know, he said, I got a job. We're going to work you about 70 hours a week and pay you $5,000 a year, and you can live in the athletic dorm. And I said, man, I'm in. I'll take it. I was just thrilled to get that chance to go back into coaching, go home to a program that I had loved my time there, and work with a guy that I was, you know, everybody that played for Roger loved him. And he was just he was one of great mentors that you could get. And then my AD there at Three Rivers was the head basketball coach as well, but his name's Gene Bess. And he was the athletic director and the head basketball coach. Won 2 national championships, won 1,300 basketball games, and was just, he put me on his bench to be an assistant men's basketball coach while I was the assistant baseball coach as well. And to learn from those two guys was just an incredible experience. I mean, two tremendous coaches, and they were exact opposites of each other too. One guy was a defensive wizard. The other one knew how to teach offense on the basketball court. One of them was the strict disciplinarian, more of a John Wooden type, and the other one was more like Denny Crum kind of, you know. So they were dynamic personalities, and so I learned a tremendous amount about managing players and coaching and just how to relate to kids and things like that. It was a great learning experience. And after 2 years of being Roger's assistant on the baseball field, then he left and went into private sales and industry. And, you know, Coach Bess asked me to, as the athletic director, he asked me to be the head baseball coach and then still stay with him as an assistant basketball coach. So I continued to do that for a time longer. And it was an unbelievable experience. And the people at Three Rivers treated me extremely well and allowed me to do stupid things and make mistakes and say stupid stuff and still kept on, you know, believing in me and pursuing that. So I'm always indebted to those men and those men and women that poured into me over there.
That helped you being able to see different coaches, different personalities, be able to make it work?
Absolutely. I mean, and I played for a lot of what I felt like were pretty good men in high school, both in basketball and baseball. You know, we'd had a lot of coaching changes when I went through, played for 4 different guys. in baseball and in basketball, both at a really small school. I mean, we graduated 36 kids in my high school class. That's how small we were. And then to go and play under Roger Patillo and Gene Best in college a little bit, and then go to Arkansas State. I played for Rich Johnson down there, who was a tremendous baseball mind. He did not communicate very well at all, but had a really great, had played professionally in the Red Sox organization. And, you know, I think he played with like Bo Ferris and some of these guys that were just, you know, incredible baseball minds, but he was not a great teacher, so to speak. And then to go back and start trying to apply my craft to it. You know, I had another guy too, that I lived with in college. He was one of my roommates and teammates at Arkansas State. And he was wanting to go into coaching as well. So his name was Matt Turner. He's now a football coach. He's been a football coach in the state of Texas for forever, high school football coach. He's been parts of, you know, both as a head coach and assistant of state football state championships down there and so forth. Now he's on the staff with UT San Antonio and what they've got going on down there. But he and I, we just, you know, there's sports specific stuff, but there's just coaching stuff too. And I've learned a lot from Matt, and he and I played a lot off of each other. And, you know, so those are all parts of my foundational blocks, like you're talking about. And then when I left Three Rivers, and Mike Tiki gave me the opportunity when Coach Reagan retired at Murray State, gave me that opportunity to come over there. And that's when I first crossed paths with you and your dad in those years.
And good for you, because not a lot of guys get that opportunity to go from junior college to Division I baseball.
Absolutely. And to do it, you know, with Coach Reagan's retirement, to go in there and work under Mike, who gave me free reign with the offense and a lot of free reign in the recruiting responsibilities and so forth. You know, Mike did a lot of wonderful things for me in my time there. And to be honest with you, you know this as well as I do, Coach Reagan had just retired, so he was still around the office a lot. He had grown up in a little bitty town in Southeast Missouri, very close to where I had grown up. And so we had a lot in common in that regard, and became another really good mentor and a friend to me, up until his death, you know, many years later. So I'm very proud to even say that I have that type of relationship with Coach Reagan, where we'd go to ABCA conventions and I'd get to room with Coach Reagan. And I can still remember one night down in Dallas, he goes, "Dave, my cardiologist says I have to have a glass of wine before bed every night. So he said, will you come downstairs and have a glass of wine with me?" And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely. I don't even like wine, but I'll go down there and have a glass." So great, great memories, you know, in those areas.
Did you have to adjust your recruiting at all going from Murray State to Belmont? Two different type of schools. Did you have to adjust recruiting wise?
When we first got here, Chris Mollebaugh was my assistant coach that came with me from Murray. And he and I took the job June 1st of 1997. And we didn't have a full roster in any shape. So we really, he and I both had junior college playing backgrounds, and I had coached in junior college. So we went out and hit a lot of junior college kids, that first summer. And Belmont, academically, it had some more challenges to it than a Murray State did, I will say that. But we were able to put together a good enough roster that we went out and had a winning record that very first year, which, you know, I'm very proud of that and the job that Chris and it. The other thing that when we got here was Dave Witten, who had been the head coach here for 36 years at that time, stayed with us and was our pitching coach that year and a part of the program. And that was a tremendous asset as well too, to have him and his Belmont ties and knowing his way around the university and so forth. He's part of that staff for 3 years. And so that was really cool as well too. But there are differences, yes, between what I recruited in junior college, and then differences between Three Rivers and Murray State from a recruiting standpoint as well too. And then of course, you know, differences then here when you get to a private Christian based institution and the academics, it's a little bit different, no doubt about it.
Any reservation to keep the old coach on staff?
Oh, Coach Witten?
Yeah.
Absolutely not. I had reservations.
That's why you're great, by the way. You're one of the best you have in the game, honestly. I don't know a lot of guys that would do that, honestly.
I had some reservations, and Mike Strickland, who had been my athletic director at Murray State for 4 years, when Belmont made the decision to go from NAIA all the way to Division I back in 96, nobody was doing that, Brian. Nobody was making that big of a jump. And Dr. Trout at that time had just decided that he wanted to take Belmont athletics all the way to Division I in one fell swoop. Well, in order to do that, I would say I believe he thought it was a good idea to go find an athletic director that had Division I experience at the time. Well, lo and behold, he hires Mike Strickland from Murray State to come down here and implement and build an athletic department. And before Mr. Strickland had left Murray State, he took me out to lunch and said, listen, I'm going to call you in about 6, 7, 8 months and ask you to come down here and be our head coach. And he said, when he got down here then, after that first year, he said, our head coach, he doesn't want to make the move as a head coach to Division I and learn a whole new set of rules. Dave was 69 years old at that time, and he didn't want to go through being a head coach and all the paperwork and the new, you know, compliance laws and so forth. And so what he said is he would like to stay on and be a part of your staff. And I was like, Mike, do you really think that's going to work? This guy's been running it for the last 36 years. He said, you do this. You come down here and spend one full day with Coach Witten and just hang out with him. And he said, at the end of that day, if you tell me it won't work, then we'll figure out another way to take care of Coach Witten. But he said, if you meet him and spend a day with him, I think you'll understand how it's going to work. And of course, I come down here and spend the day with Dave Witten, who was such a tremendous mentor for me in my life. And because as humble, had been doing it forever, had played pro ball in the Washington Senators organization, but one of the finest human beings. And then he and his wife, Martha, became dear friends to me. And I've got their picture on my wall right here, right now, the two of them, because even up until Dave's passing when he was 84 years old, and then Martha and I, she was the biggest baseball fan and Atlanta Braves fan that I ever knew. And she and I would talk on the phone constantly, and I'd try to get over and see her in Murfreesboro every chance that I could. So that ended up, I'm telling you, Ryan, becoming one of the biggest blessings in my life, because it was the beginning of a wonderful friendship and relationship with those two people.
Love it. You guys have great resources there, it seems like. Do you have to do much fundraising?
Well, I tell you what, we started out doing fundraising when I first got here, and you'll laugh about this because you were competing against us. I think, well, no, you might have been gone by 97. What year did you graduate?
That was my senior year.
Yeah. So in 98, you know, the spring of 98, Belmont had always taken vans everywhere they went to go play. A lot of programs did that back in that day. But one of the things that I was, a part of there at Murray is Coach Tiki and I decided we wanted to try to take a bus. So we started doing a little bit of fundraising to offset the cost difference between three vans and one bus. And so I found an old bus company out of Clarksville, Tennessee, that it was just, it's kind of a hokey story. But we did fundraising. And so then we were able to take a bus. Now it looked like the bus that the Cleveland Indians traveled in Major League, the movie. That's the kind of bus that we were taking, and it's smoking, and I could get into a lot of bus stories with you on that. But fundraising started with that, and then I've been fortunate enough to be here long enough now that in 28 years I have a lot of former players who are alumni, and they've reached a point in their career and their success that they have been generous in giving back. And then we always do, a reach out with our players where they'll reach out to 15 or 20 moms, aunts, uncles, grandpa, and they'll send us some checks and things like that. So we do those type of little fundraisers. But then we've had a lot of really good friends of the program, both either alumni that are connected in that way or people that I've been able to develop relationships with since we've moved here to Nashville. And so I'm not a, I don't see myself as a great fundraiser, but I've been really blessed.
You're great at relationships though. And that's fundraising. Well, you're great at relationships.
Well, thank you. But I, that's, if I have any gifts, I would say that I really enjoy people, and I like to serve people or help people in any way that I can. And so I think that's a great way to start as a coach, is if you have those two things. But I, man, I love people. I can tell you that.
You're extremely humble. Were you raised that way? Is that upbringing? I mean, small town, Midwest.
Yeah. My parents, you know, we lived in Denver when I was just a baby. I have seven brothers and sisters, five of them older than me. And so my father was a high-rise construction worker that had a terrible accident on the eighth story. He was a guy that walked the I-beams, walked the girders, you know. Well, he had a fall and broke his seven vertebrae in his neck. And they told my mom he wasn't going to live. And then a couple of days later, they said, well, we think he might live, but it'll be a quadriplegic. And then, you know, a month or two later, they said, well, we think he'll be paralyzed from the waist down, but we're starting to see some activity in the upper body. And when my dad, who had been out for a long time, now this is a man who had been, during the Depression, raised in the middle of Denver, dropped off by his mom when he was just a child, 6, 7, 8 years old, at the Catholic orphanage, because she couldn't afford, you know, to feed them even. And so he was raised in a Catholic orphanage. He had gotten in a lot of fights. He had a lot of anger issues. A priest turned, it's kind of like a classic story where one of the priests saw something in him, turned him into a boxer. And then he got into Golden Gloves boxing, and then he got into championships, and he started winning like the whole Western United States and middleweight class of Golden Gloves and things like that. And ended up in 1941, Ring Magazine, I guess, had named him the number one amateur middleweight in the nation at one point, or ranked him as high as that. And then December 7th came and World War II started, and he went into the military and, you know, did a lot of, I think what you might say, crazy things in the military as well. He ended up winning a Silver Star. So he was a tough guy, I guess is what I'm saying, and had a rough upbringing and background. And, you know, they walked in and my mom told him that what they had said, that he was going to be a quadriplegic and, you know, so forth. And he said, you tell that doctor to go straight to hell, because I'm walking out of here. So 2 years later, he walks out of the hospital, which we all know that, you know, that type of determination doesn't heal a severed spinal cord, but that type of determination can get you through a lot of things and take you a long way. And so a large family, we moved to Missouri, bought a 160-acre rock farm is what I call it. And I grew up 7 miles or 7.5 miles down gravel roads out in the middle of nowhere is what I would say. We were 7.5 miles from a town of 300 people. And that was city to me, you know. So when you say humble, we were poor. And it's one of the greatest blessings that I've ever had, is to have the seven brothers and sisters, the parents that I have, and to grow up on that rock farm in Southeast Missouri. Because you just learned a whole lot of things. And you learned how to do more with less. You learned how to get by. You know, it was a great, I look back on that so fondly, and I feel so fortunate to have the family that I have. But none of them knew anything about sports. My dad didn't really know sports. My mom didn't, you know, none of my older brothers and sisters cared anything about sports. So I'm out here. Plus I was surrounded. I had two older brothers and one brother that was younger than me, 6 years, who he and I both ended up playing college baseball. But I had four girls around me. I had four sisters that I was stuck right in the middle of, and none of them wanted to play sports or play baseball. So I played a lot of rock ball and by myself out there on the farm. So,
instilled your love of baseball then? How'd you find baseball?
Found baseball at, you know, I would go to school, and in first grade, I don't know what made me navigate to it, but, I can remember in first grade, the fourth and fifth graders would have a softball game going on way down here in the lower into the playground, and then all my classmates and I are stuck up here on the merry-go-rounds and the swings, and you know, and I'm looking down there going, I'm headed down there. And so I went down there, finagled my way into their game, and then got to playing with these older kids, you know, fourth, fifth graders, and I'm in first grade. Well, the next thing you know, I'm playing well, and I'm keeping up with them, and they accepted me then into the game. And I think that was just the beginning. It was just, I just wanted to play ball. I'd play baseball. I'd play basketball. I'd play football. You got a ball, I'm in. And I'd play. And so how I found it, I don't know. We, you know, you didn't get a lot of games on television. We lived out in the middle of nowhere. So we had one channel that we got regularly. And if it was cloudy enough, we might get a second one, you know, partway. So I watched a lot of these games where it's nothing but just snow and you can't tell. I can remember watching football games on TV growing up, and I'm probably 5 years old, 6 years old. And it's the picture is so bad. You can't tell who the home team is and who the visiting team is, but I'm fired up and I'm loving it. So I just couldn't get enough sports. And the ironic part is all seven of my brothers and sisters and both my parents are just voracious readers and more intellectual than I am. And they talk, we get together at Thanksgiving and they talk about they're reading this author or that author. And, you know, that's just not who I am. I'm just wired differently than they are. My parents used to buy Sports Illustrated just to try to get me to read something, because I wouldn't read anything unless it was about sports. So,
hey, I do want to thank you. During COVID, you let us host a Barnstormer. We were scrambling during COVID, and I do want to thank you. It was the sites, you know, you're not technically off campus, but enough off campus. And so I do thank you, because we were scrambling that fall to get things in.
We were honored to have you guys. That was, you know, that's a good thing. I love what you guys do with that. And you know, my assistant coaches at that time were a good part of what you guys had going there and did a good job with that. Coach Smith, Coach Longshore, I believe, was with
Coach
me at Longshore's
that time. On the pitching hot stove this year.
Yeah. Well, he's
fold.
He's been put on the major league staff with Cleveland. And so very, very happy for Caleb and proud of him. And just, he's just a good dude, man.
Yes.
Good country boy from Alabama.
Are you still heavily involved with the catchers and the hitters?
Yeah. Well, you know, Coach Steen and Coach Craig, our third assistant, do such a great job with our hitting and our approach and everything. I love it. I can't get enough of it. I want to throw BP, and I'm at the batting cage every day, or at the, you know, on the field with them every time that we're hitting. So I'm doing more. Jason is handling more of the general philosophy and the offensive approach. I call him my offensive coordinator, and he does a tremendous job with putting together our offense. But I love talking hitting, and I love working with kids and trying to. I leave it to where I do some mechanical tweaks, or maybe just some slight adjustments mechanically, but leave most of the lion's share of that to him, because I'm a firm believer that too many cooks can spoil the broth when you're talking hitting, and you don't want to get too many conflicting ideas or voices going on in a hitter's head. I oversee general philosophy of offense and tweak things that I think that we need to do, but I try to let my coaches do their job, and they're all really well qualified and, you know, have a lot of experience and success in their background. So you want to really be careful there that you don't get too much going on for young hitters. But catchers, I work with them every day and love it. I mean, I really just love working with catching. And, you know, catchers are crazy anyway. You got to love pain to some extent. You got to love getting dirty and sweaty and all of those things. And, you know, just kind of grinding into it. So it takes a special breed to enjoy it. But man, when you get with a bunch of catchers that are like-minded in that regard, the drill work and all this stuff, I love watching good catching coaches too, like Coach Griffin, you know, where Carson Newman does such a great job with catching and catching instruction. And just, you know, you get around guys like that, it's just like, you know, Tim the Tool Man, you know, more more testosterone.
And you guys have had good catching.
We've been blessed with some really good athletes back there, some guys that do just a great job, and we really take pride in it. We talk about it as a catching core, you know, some of what our goals are and what we want to try to accomplish, and And being that guy that can make a difference in the game, maybe not with his bat or anything else, but just your will and what you can do for a pitcher and little subtle things to make a pitcher better and to help this guy out because you know him and you know what his needs are and things like that. And that goes from everything to receiving, to fielding the position, to when to pat the guy on the back and when to try to get after him or kick him in the butt a little bit. You know, all of those things are a part of who a catcher is and what they can contribute for sure.
And I was trying to see you last year at South Carolina. You were dealing with some health issues, yep. And I'm happy for you now. You said your pre-call, you said you're doing fine with that.
Yeah.
But how long did it take those guys to wear you down about the taller machine angle on Sunday, which I love. I love I love the longer legs, and I thought it was great that you guys were doing that on Sunday. I thought it was awesome.
Oh yeah. I've been big on, you know, we've been putting our pitching machines on the back of bullpen, you know, on mounds and things like that, portable mounds. We've been trying to create some of that angle. You know, everybody makes these adjustments, but even before you could buy the long legs, and I can remember taking, you know, regular legs over to the physical plant and talking to those guys over there and saying, hey, can you get me some steel pipe, this exact same diameter, so that we can make these legs each, you know, 18, 2 feet, 36 inches longer so that we can increase and get guys in the physical plan, explain it to them and show them what you want to do. And they get excited about that. Then they're ready to help you, you know, and we have good people like that here at our physical plan.
Does it take your hitters a while to adjust to that?
Yeah, it does. Especially if you're using any type, you know, now you, with TrackMan technology and all, you check your spin. And if you create good spin and ride on a high fastball coming out from that, if you create the right type of vertical and downward movement and, you know, so forth, all of those things, I think translate. All you're trying to do, it's real simple. It's the same thing that we used to do 43 years ago in both baseball and basketball practice. It's the overload theory, where you're trying to create and make practice more difficult than what they're going to see in the game. And then, and that's, I, Coach Best taught me that. I mean, he handed me his blue tackle dummy basically for basketball practice. And he said, Dave, here's what I want you to do. Every time this guy comes in the lane, just hit him as hard as you can with this pad when he's trying to score. And that, you know, well, I learned the overload theory very quickly. They're doing that with him. But I got to tell you, I was really good at knocking those guys down with that blue pad too.
What are some other challenging things that you do that you feel like help?
Well, I think that you're trying to test them. You know, you, a lot of the things that we're talking about from the pitching machine carry over into, you want throws to be done properly. You want in and out to be taken properly. You know, some of these basic teaching tools have been around for 100 years and more, and those do not go out of style. Teach kids. And you create pressure by high expectations and consequences. It can be a little bitty consequence, but it's an agitation or an irritant to a player, as you well know, that conforms or shapes or puts pressure on them to where then they learn how to perform and to do it. And if then at some point, you know, you want your players to get a little bit of that edge about him where it's like, screw the old man. I'm going to do this in spite of him bitching at me or complaining at me or whatever. You know what I mean? And so when you get that mix going on, then you grow players and you grow men and you grow them into being able to handle a lot of other things in their life too. And I think it helps them in many ways become better citizens, better husbands, and better fathers if you do it the right way too.
Healthy confrontation is a great thing.
It is. And learning how to.
We're missing it. We are missing it in society right now, healthy confrontation.
Well, and I think the term that you just you're using, healthy confrontation, I think that's an extremely important one because I'm all about testosterone. I'm all about us being who we were intended to be. But you have to learn how to be able to get into conflict or confrontation and deal with your work your way through that without it exploding or becoming something unhealthy that you're talking about.
And that's what we're seeing now.
Yes.
Like you're seeing people hold on. In general society, you're seeing people hold on to stuff so long, and then it just explodes.
Yes.
Rather than learning how to get it out and then release it and learn from it, we've got to do a better job of trying to bring that back and teach it to society as a whole, because that's what we're missing right now in society.
Well, in sports especially, yeah, should be leading the way in that, instead of, you know, we're seeing even, you know, you saw on conference championship weekends, I think it was a rivalry weekend in college football, where everybody's trying to plant a flag. And I was really, I don't know Sarkisian from Texas. I don't have a college football team that I care about, or I love college football. I don't have one particular team. But when they won that game that night, I think it was against Texas A&M on Texas A&M's field, and he ran his guys off of the logo, I said, that's what we should be more all about, you know. But everybody's got to run their program the way they see fit too, Ryan. And I accept that as well. I just don't always have to be a part of it, is what I would say too. You know, you got to let people.
Baker Mayfield talked about it. You know, he talked about the Red River rivalry, and he's like, "Well, yeah, Texas and Oklahoma have been doing that to each other for years."
Yes.
But I think that's the other flip side of that's like, don't even pay attention to it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I get both sides, but he's like, they've been doing that forever, and it's really like a non. It's nothing even really to talk about, because they've been doing that to each other forever. And it's like, okay, go play better, beat the other team. And if you lose, then you just expect that might happen, but don't worry about it. Walk off the field and go about your business.
Well, it's about out of control escalation.
Yes.
And it's about not being able to keep things in a healthy perspective and keep healthy boundaries.
Yep.
And we have, if anybody's going to give these players healthy boundaries, we as coaches definitely need to be doing that. But if we're going to do that, then we have to have healthy boundaries in our behavior as well too, I feel like. And that gets lost in the shuffle at times too.
Is this a pivotal time for Division I as far as legislation?
No doubt.
I mean, it reminds me of the early 90s and the early 2000s when we were trying to get stuff changed. This is a pivotal time for you guys right now.
There is your nail on the head. You're right over the target, as they say. And there'll be things that'll happen, I think, in this next 5 to 10 years that are really it's going to make or break college athletics, because we are in danger of losing college athletics, in my opinion. And we're in danger of bankrupting mid-level college athletics if we're not careful as well, too. So hopefully the leadership that the presidents and the athletic directors can give us will bring us to bring us towards sanity rather than insanity, because it's unsustainable in the direction that we're headed right now. I do believe that.
What do you feel like the best roster number is?
Well, I know that there's a lot of talk with the 34-man roster and so forth. I think that makes it really difficult at times. I mean, yeah, everybody says, well, Major League Baseball has a 25, 26, 27-man roster.
They got four levels of minor leagues.
Exactly. And so you don't have all their player development is going on four other teams. All of their stopgap safety measures, if they have, you can call a guy up if you need to. So I think that in today's world, with pitching staff and pitching being the way it is, I mean, when I first started coaching in 1982, I might have a guy go out and throw 148 pitches that day, and they got mad at me if I came to take them out after that, because they wanted to finish the game. So the game has evolved in that way, and the way that the game has evolved, roster numbers become a little bit more important. I'm not a guy that's ever brought in 50, 60, 70 kids in the fall, and, you know, that's just not been part of my landscape or where I was at. But I do think 34 is going to be a little bit tight. I know they're talking about maybe starting at 38 in the fall and being down to 34 by December 1st. Who knows what's really going to happen? And this court ruling still has to take place in April before any of these type of things.
I feel bad for you guys, because it's just a guessing game right now. At least if you know, then you can adjust. Baseball coaches have always been good about adjusting with whatever the legislation piece is. I just think there needs to be find a way to get your number to start the school year and keep the entire guys. I just don't like the cut down piece. Put a number on it, and then that way coach knows and the players know that you're going to be with the team the whole year.
It changes the dynamic of the relationship, and it makes it more, it makes it more of a you know, a transitional relationship, you know, than it does a.
It's transactional then because
transactional. That's
because,
the word I was
looking. Because again, that's the way the rules have been set up that way. I just don't like the cut down piece. Like, let's get to a good number, and that's what you're going to keep for the whole year. And
I agree.
It cleans a lot of things up for everybody.
Well, it makes it to me, it's a cultural challenge. You challenge the culture when you start knowing that we're going to have to try to cut some of this down before we get there. I don't make the rules. I only try to live within them. And so what I would say is this, and I had a young coach ask me this a couple of months ago. He said, man, how are you dealing with all this stuff when we're talking about these roster limits, the scholarships, all this type of stuff? Because you know as well as I do, they're talking about bumping it up to a maximum of 34 scholarships. Well, mid-levels aren't going to get 30. Most of us aren't going to get, you know, my AD looks at me and goes, yeah, you got 11.7. Be happy about that, you know, kind of thing. So you're going to have all kinds of discrepancies in within your autonomy or the balance of who's got what. But the thing that I would say is this, since COVID, I have looked at it as, well, this is how it is today. And this is what our team's going to look like this year. And what it's going to be next year, we'll deal with that as we start evolving towards that. And it really takes me back, as you mentioned, those junior college days at Three Rivers, where you're turning over at least half your roster every year. And you got some kids leaving because they, you know, my car doesn't work, so I ain't coming back in the spring, you know, or whatever. So, or I got to go to work or whatever. And so you develop some of those skill sets coaching in junior college, because you've always got a lot of turnover and you've got your roster is never always in flux.
Do you think a lot of your career path ends up being some luck?
No doubt. Well,
for everybody, fortune. Right? And for yeah. Fortune. I love it. Thank you fortune. For checking me out. Fortune.
I think coaching at the college it's fortuitous. You've got to be good. You've got to work hard. You've got to do everything right. But that does not guarantee you any kind of success. There is fortune involved. Baseball is a very fortuitous sport, in my opinion, just because, you know, you can do everything right, square a pitch up, hit 100 mile an hour exit velocity, but it's right at the guy with the wind blowing in to left field and he catches it easily, you know. Or you can stick your butt out, get fooled, gork a ball over the first baseman's head with the bases loaded and the pitcher beat you in every way possible, but you just drove in three runs, you know.
Do you have a fail forward moment? You have something you thought was going to set you back, but looking back now, it helped you move forward? Could be personal or professional.
Both, you know, probably jobs that I've applied for that I thought, man, I should have had this job. You know, I'd be a finalist. I'd be in the interview process. I'd be down between me and one other person. And I tell you, to every one of these situations, you look at it 10 years later and you go, man, I'm so glad that I didn't get that job that I thought I just had to have, or, you know. So I would encourage younger coaches with that and just say, you know what? And I truly believe this, Ryan, but God's got a better plan for us than we have for ourselves a lot of times. So what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to get up every day, go to work as hard as we can, and do the best that we can to try to let go and not worry about the things that we don't have control over, you know.
Have you always been that way, or has that grown with experience?
Well, I think my parents taught me a lot of that. My father's accident, you know what I mean? Nothing that it wasn't his fault. It was truly an accident. My mother was born in a sod house out in the middle of the eastern Colorado prairie, you know. So they grew up with hard knocks, but both extremely intelligent, both very well read. Neither one of them had more than an eighth grade education. And yet my dad taught himself trigonometry and calculus and algebra, you know. So they were very much pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get busy and go do something. And, you know, I think it was my mom that instilled in me, if you're having a bad day or you don't feel good about life, then get up and go do something for somebody else. And I guarantee you, you'll feel better if you do something for someone else. Where that's the epitome of a servant's heart, in my opinion.
Get you out of a funk. Dive in. Just Absolutely. Like with players, you know, if you're not going well, dive into your teammates.
Yes.
Start picking your teammates up. You'll and that's a karma thing too. The God, universe, like you start picking other people up, it's going to turn around for you at some point.
Yeah, in life and in sports, you reap what you sow many, many times. I agree totally.
Have you had to adjust your schedule at all with what you had going on with your stomach last year? Have you had to adjust your schedule at all?
No. It was just a matter. What happened was is back in 2008, I had a bacteria that created a blockage in my colon in the off season. It was in fall, and I had to have about 6 or 8 inches cut out, you know, of my colon. Well, that had formed over the last 16 years or so. It had formed scar tissue, and apparently some of that had kinked. It had attached itself to one of my intestines and then kinked it and really created another blockage, so to speak. So I went in the hospital on February the 5th and then came out on February the 14th, but I was healthy, feeling good. I'm thinking I'll be back in another week. I'm hoping I'm going to get back for that trip to South Carolina last year. And sure enough, the next day I had an infection starting, and it created abscesses throughout my abdomen. It was about an 12 inch incision that I had. I tell everybody that's why I look pregnant now, is because it's the surgery. It's not me getting old and fat. But anyway, that abscess ran wild, and really, I ended up being on antibiotics for about 50 days. I ended up having drainage tubes coming out of my abdomen and then into a bag on my hip for 52 days. And man, that was, you know, I missed 30 games last year. But our team did great while I was gone. I mean, we get a win down at South Carolina on the road. We go up to Indiana and beat them in a game, you know, up there at their place one game. And we're playing, you know, really well against teams like Alabama and Vanderbilt, you know. And so I got back and I told the kids, I said, you know, I think I'm going to just start taking the first 30 games off every year and let you guys just have fun.
How were you able to handle communication with the team while you're out?
Well, I was still, you know, I would come and I would speak with the team and stay in touch. I couldn't get in uniform because I had the drainage tubes coming out of my abdomen. But I would come and just sit and watch the games, but I wouldn't participate. I wouldn't dress out. And then after the games, I would at least just make sure that they knew I was still alive and talk with them a little bit and show up, just try to be present as much as I possibly could. I tell you, the other thing that we had was, in addition to the great coaching staff that I had and was blessed with, we had really good senior leadership on that team last year that, you know, we had 16 guys graduate last year. Well, they all had played for me and knew how we should go about our business and were good captains and so forth that took care of the small things and allowed us to play.
Isn't that the hope, though, as a coach, like that they can do it if you're not around?
Yeah,
doesn't that speak to you and how you have things set up there? Because they were able to get after it still, even though you weren't there all the time.
Well, and, you know, this goes all the way back to John Wooden, who was, you know, he was kind of a mentor and someone that basketball coach Gene Best at Three Rivers that I had worked with, he and Roger Patillo, they would say, if we're doing things right, then when it comes game time, we just let our kids go play and let them do it the way they know how to do it. And so you hope as a coach, That's what when things are going really well and the players are driving the bus, let's just say it like it is. If the players are driving the bus and they're doing a good job with it, the best thing you can do is just sit in that other seat and keep your mouth shut and let them drive the bus right. And so that's what you're always hoping for. And we had really, you know, like I say, AJ Gore, Jason Steen, and Will Craig did a tremendous job in my absence last year. And I think we were just as good, if not better, in my absence as anything. But I was sure excited to get back, I can tell you that.
What are some final thoughts before I let you go?
Well, just the fact that, you know, one, the things that you and I talked about earlier, some of this new legislation, I have concerns about it. I have concerns about how finances and economics are going to be affecting college athletics, period, not just baseball, but all sports. And of course, baseball is very susceptible to some of these hindrances that we run into, no doubt. It can be an expensive sport at times because of roster size and equipment, things like that. But
yeah, but tuition dollars make up for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody ever talks about it. Administrators don't want to talk about it. The baseball brings in a lot of revenue, tuition.
Tuition, yeah. But if you start going to 34 scholarships, then you're actually, you're changing that model.
Yep.
But I agree with you. I think we had a really sweet spot where we were generating a lot of revenue for universities with our roster sizes and so forth. But the other thing that comes to my mind, or the last thought that I have is I hear this all the time, and I get this question all the time is, you know, man, these kids today, you know, and people complaining or griping about, you know, well, how do you think players have changed over your 40 years of doing this? And I'll be honest with you. Parents are different. There's no doubt about that. Parents are probably the biggest problem at times, but these kids are still motivated by exactly the same things. They're motivated. They want to be challenged. They want to be held accountable. They want to work hard. You know, the guys that are doing it right. I have a lot of optimism about our future. I have a lot of optimism about our nation and where things are headed, because these young guys that I'm coaching now, 43 years later, they're smarter. They're more talented. They work hard. They want to be challenged. They want to be held accountable and so forth. I have optimism. I think there's sunshine.
I get reminders of it all the time about this generation coming up. They get it. They are smart, and they understand about community.
Yes.
I think that's where they have it ahead of some of the other generation, is they really are involved with their community as a whole. Like, they see the benefit of helping everybody.
Amen.
And they're rallying each other in this time right now of we're in this thing together. So,
well, and some of these kids
as well,
they're less selfish right now. They are more team minded. They love being a part. Here's the thing that I see in these young people today is they love being a part of a team, because it's something greater than just that's all this focus upon them and it's focus on self. We're not designed. God didn't design us to be the center of the universe. He designed us to be a part of that thing. And I just have optimism. I'll say it that way. Even at this old age, I believe that things are getting better. I really do.
Love it. Thanks for your time, Dave. I always appreciated you.
Well,
happy for you, man. This is awesome. Really happy for
you.
Thank you.
I love our friendship, and I'm grateful for it, Ryan. And I hope that you'll give your dad my best when you talk to him. I have great memories of him and competing against him at Bossy Field, and you know, just some of those things. And you know, it was good times.
Great memories.
Yes. Thank you very much.
I'm so pumped for Coach Jarvis. In a current society where it seems like self-promoters are the only ones getting recognized, it's awesome to see him get this recognition. This truly is a win for the good guys. Thanks again to John Litchfield, Zach Hale, Matt West, and Antonio Walker in the ABCA office for all the help on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to me via email, rbrownlee@abca.org, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at @coachb_ABCA. Or direct message me via the MyBSA app. This is Ryan Brownlee signing off for the American Baseball Coaches Association. Thanks, and leave it better for those behind you. Wait for another.